then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 20th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, first let me give a shout-out to scouting trip arrivals Jake and Julie. Julie's touring Idaho. I shouldn't say where Jake is due to his ROTC commitment. Now, I've had a bit of a personal success as well, although it may not lead to migration anytime soon. Ironically, for those of you who accuse me of being too crotchety and terse in my email responses, I do, on occasion, take newcomers in hand and try to, quote-unquote, wake them up. Yes, I know, I'm the one who keeps telling you that just waking people up isn't enough, but I never said we shouldn't try it. After all, racial awareness is the first step to action, it's just that we never seem to take the second and third steps. I just said that waking people up is meaningless without acting on one's newfound knowledge. Anyway, I got an email this week from a conservative I'd been working on, and he says, "You know, Harold, damn if I don't think you're right about the Jews now. I've taken to watching for all the Jewish names at the end credits of TV shows and movies, and finally it just clicked. It all fell into place. The hook-nosed bastards really do control Hollywood and the entertainment industry. Thank you, Harold." Acknowledging the Jewish question is one small step for a man, but it's a giant leap for the white race, because once you're Jew-aware, you can never become Jew-ignorant again. For the rest of your life, you will always notice all those Bergs and Steins and Rons showing up in proximity to things that are filthy and racially destructive. I've gotten a good reaction so far on the two shortcasts that I've done, which are shorter podcasts consisting of me rapping for a bit on a single subject. There will be more, mostly topics that I've already covered in previous Radio Free Northwests. A few people have told me that they've downloaded and listened to all of the podcasts from beginning to end, but as there are now something like 180 of them, that's going to be less and less feasible for a lot of folks. I am trying to give you guys something that you can use in converting others with these shortcasts. So you comrades who are making CDs of my material, make sure that you make CDs of these shorties as well and pass them around to likely candidates for migration. We're getting a lot of new listeners every week. The stat counter keeps track of how many visits we get per IP address, and it is showing me more and more first-time visitors. They need to know the reasons that we advocate Northwest migration and Northwest independence and the way in which we counter the various naysayers that they will almost certainly run across in their wanderings around the Internet. We have a lot of these circling around the Northwest imperative. Naysayers, I mean. By naysayer, I mean a kind of individual whose whole public reaction to the idea of the Northwest imperative is, "No, no, no, we must not do this. We cannot do this. It will never work. Don't ask me what will work because I don't know and I haven't got any alternative plan, but whatever else happens, no, 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 we can't do the Northwest. Must not do the Northwest. Anything but the Northwest. And besides, Harold Covington is the son of Satan." This is a kind of individual that anyone who's been in the movement for any length of time will very quickly recognize. They're kind of similar to the explanologists in psychic research, and I don't know how many of you have ever done any serious ghost hunting or UFO spotting, or who are interested in psychic or paranormal research. Actually, we've got several of them that I know of, one of them a parapsychologist and one of them a Bigfoot hunter, plus a couple of witches. Anyway, in any paranormal field, be it ghosts or UFOs or whatever, there is a phenomenon called the explanologist, who always appears on the scene anytime something major is happening. Now, the explanologist is supposedly a skeptic, and he often poses as some kind of scientific expert, but his real purpose is not to explain a given psychic or paranormal phenomenon, but to explain it away. He starts from the premise that whatever it is, be it an apparition or a poltergeist or a UFO or reincarnation or whatever, there just plain has to be another explanation because the paranormal does not exist, period, end of story. Not a rational explanation necessarily, just any other explanation than what it appears to be. Occam's razor is completely lost on paranormal explanologists. Now, whatever it is, it cannot possibly be, must not be, a flying saucer or reincarnation or a near-death experience or whatever. The explanologist's function in paranormal research is to poo-poo everything and argue that there is no paranormal world at all. Therefore, anything that indicates different, up to and including videotaping personal eyewitnesses, is either fraud or delusion or sunspots. There is not, cannot, and must not be any supernatural world, period, end of story. The classic example of explanologists finally beating down and shouting down what was, in fact, a pretty clear example of a paranormal phenomenon was crop circles. Now, if you will look them up on the internet, you will find that all kinds of articles are there making the claim that crop circles have been, quote-unquote, debunked as hoaxes or sunspots or freak tornadoes, whatever, but this is simply not true. No one has ever successfully created a hoax crop circle that looks anything like the real thing, and yet the received wisdom that you will absorb from the net these days from these explanologists is now that they have been quote-unquote debunked. Now, of course, this leads into the question of who are the explanologists? Why are the explanologists? And why do they invariably turn up on the scene of any kind of paranormal phenomenon? Who sends them? Who turns them loose on paranormal phenomena with orders to debunk at all costs? In whose interest is it to convince humanity that there is no supernatural world and that what we see is what we get and nothing else? Now, there we enter a real realm of super paranoid conspiracy theory, which I won't get into. Now, why am I babbling about this? Our naysayers in the movement are somewhat like explanologists. They really come into their own with the internet because it allows for postings under multiple names using sock puppets, and if they can afford it, or if they work for somebody who can afford it, they use something called persona management software, which allows someone to run multiple internet identities with what appears to be different IP addresses so as to influence opinion, take over blogs and comment sections, shout down whoever the targeted people or ideas are, so forth and so on. No one ever really knows who these naysayers and internets are or what their motivations may be. But any time anyone in the movement comes up with an idea that sounds promising, like the Northwest Imperative, for example, all of a sudden he finds himself getting piled on all over the internet by various email handles claiming all kinds of experience and expertise, except no one really knows who they are. It's not just us. I've seen this happen time and time again with other people as well. But they all have the same message. No, 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 we must not do that. Don't even think about it. It will never, ever work. No, 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 whatever we do, we must never do that. These people's function seems to be nothing more than to naysay and quibble and rubbish every idea that any white nationalist comes up with, and explain to us all in lengthy detail why it will never, ever possibly work, and we must never, ever even try it. It makes you wonder, in whose interest these people are acting? Like the old legal saying goes when investigating a crime, qui bono, who benefits? Now, I'm not suggesting that all movement naysayers are working for the ADL or Cass Sunstein's cognitive dissonance operation, because that probably isn't the case. I think most white nationalist naysayers are basically just unhappy and resentful people of the kind that democracy produces in bulk and who can only get personal satisfaction and a sense of personal worth and identity out of tearing everything down. Now, the naysayers who put down the Northwest Imperative all the time come up with the same objections or distractions, and I'll be dealing with those on some of my short casts. But there are also a lot of serious and good people who simply can't wrap their minds around the whole Northwest thing in its entirety. The idea of a separate white nation here on the North American continent is one that's hard for most people to digest. But, like I said, this is going to be more of a topic for future short casts. Right now, I want to move on to the subject of Bill White. Apparently, the guy who runs the Bill White Trial Update blog, who, by the by, is not me, and whose actual name I don't know, got a visit last week from our friends in the silk suits who scared his wife so bad that he agreed to stop posting, but a few days later he seems to have recovered his nerve, and so now he's posting again. Now, I've been covering the Bill White story on Radio Free Northwest as well and on my blogs for quite some time, and I get a lot of people asking me about his actual case, what it is he is actually alleged to have done. And that's hard for me to respond to because Bill has asked me, and this other guy as well, to refrain from discussing his legal cases in detail in case we might inadvertently mess something up for him. But I'm going to play for you folks now two brief telephone interviews that the American Free Press reporter David Gaharry did with Bill White. Now, I normally do not pinch audio files from other right-wing websites, but in this case, yeah, I nicked this one. I know that's rude, and I apologize, but this is some important audio, quite possibly historic audio, because as macabre and depressing as this sounds, it may be the last time we hear Bill White's actual voice. We don't know what's going to happen to him in there. They clearly are obsessed with Bill White to the point of madness. And once you get in these people's power, there is never any guarantee that you're going to come out of those places alive, no matter what your actual sentence is. Now, right now, they're giving him a really humongous dose of diesel therapy. He's being moved between federal camps at intervals of 5 to 6 days. And, of course, he's denied email. If they lock him up in Roanoke City Jail for any length of time, he'll be denied both email and books. Now, Bill was thrown into solitary for several weeks in Oklahoma after giving these two interviews for the offense of unauthorized media contact. Now, there is nothing that our so-called justice system hates worse than ordinary white people telling their stories where somebody might listen. And now the FBI is actually harassing people on the outside who are giving him any internet coverage at all, so it's obvious that the dictatorship still fears something that Bill White has to say. Or else it's just incredible mindless malice, like bad little boys pulling the wings off of flies.
You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is William A. White from prison, who's former commander of the American National Socialist Workers Party and a regular contributor to the Barnes Review and American Free Press newspaper. Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Dave.
Bill, for the benefit of the listeners, first let them know where you're at right now.
Right now I'm in the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Chicago, though I'm actually about to leave here tomorrow for parts unknown. It appears they may have misfiled me. You know, I've been prosecuted 7 times by the federal government in the last 5 years, and there's been a number of things going on. The case I'm up here on was a case that has been dismissed twice. It's now at the Supreme Court. It's kind of an interesting issue. I used to publish a website called Overthrow.com, and we had about 150,000 unique readers every month. And we published some material that was critical of a juror in the Matthew Hale case. And the government charged me criminally with soliciting a violent felony for the fact that I criticized him in front of an audience that the government argued was inherently violent. And while the judge threw the case out twice, the Seventh Circuit, a Jewish fellow named Posner, writing the opinion for them, ruled that the government was correct and that people who share my point of view are so inherently criminal that to merely criticize somebody in front of such an audience is, in fact, a solicitation of a violent felony. And that's where I am right now. I was supposed to travel to Virginia for a 2255 appeal. This is another issue, very similar issue, but what happened there was, as it was on appeal at the Fourth Circuit, a Jewish fellow named Neuberger wrote an opinion upholding a similar case, but there were two dissents on the opinion, and the case was going to go in bank when suddenly my attorney, a woman named Melissa Scoggins, just simply didn't file the appeal. And she later admitted that she had been advised by somebody that it was no longer in her interest to represent me, and so she had deliberately sabotaged my appeal. So that gave rise to yet another appeal. And the issue there, the government has admitted that my attorney was tampered with, but has argued that I did not have a right to not have my attorney tampered with, if you can understand that. They're claiming that because appeals beyond the panel level do not carry a right to counsel, there is no right to what's called effective assistance to counsel, which means, as my friend Mike Piper said, that if I pay an attorney $50,000, the government can give her $100,000 and win the case without it ever being heard at a higher court.
Amazing.
Those are the formal legal issues. Now, those who've read American Free Press and have read about my case probably know what I was really arrested for was this. In these cases, there have been seven. There are two that are still alive. The others have been mostly dismissed. But there was an informant, sort of the James Bond of informants. His name was Harold Turner. And this guy was being sent all over the world. He was sent to Iraq, to Brazil. He was intercepting weapons for the Iraqi resistance and so forth. And he got out of control and he was fired by the FBI. Well, he decided to try to get a contract back by setting me up. And I have to say, I was never charged with this, but he recruited two people that I marginally knew, I'd spoken to, and had them both tell the same lie to federal officials and persuaded the government to arrest me for crimes that I was never even charged with. And when the government realized I was innocent of those charges, they began throwing these speech cases on me to try to find some reason to justify having arrested me in the first place. So now, 5 years on, I've been released twice, I've been re-imprisoned twice, and I am sitting here, hopefully, waiting for some court somewhere to recognize I'm not guilty.
Now, you never really did anything except they're going after you because of your words?
Well, that's exactly right. Both the cases where they've achieved convictions have involved just simply criticizing people. The first case involved criticizing a federal juror. The second case involved criticizing people who had brought a essentially false federal lawsuit and had gone to the newspapers and the television. And basically what the court has found is that as long as the newspapers and the television are promoting the government's point of view, that's fine. They can comment however they like on these things. But when you start promoting a point of view different than that of the government, then you start having an issue.
You're in jail. Did you hit somebody? Did you kill somebody?
No, there's absolutely been no violence. But, you know, the judge pointed out that if I'd actually attacked the juror in this case with a weapon, I would have received a lower sentence than if I had simply criticized him. And that was a factor that was just mentioned at the last hearing. And you know, Dave, what this really does is it shows the nature of the Democratic system. What I was originally set up on was an alleged terror plot that fortunately I was never charged with. But during my time in federal prison, I have been subject to very extreme brutality, particularly at the beginning. I was subjected to sleep deprivation. I was thrown in cells that were freezing cold. I at one point was held overnight in a cell that was flooded with human feces, all in order to get me to confess to something that just never happened. And the first 30 months that I spent in prison, I can tell you I spent 21 of those in solitary confinement. And I have to say, thankfully, the reason I'm probably not there now is because of media like yours that has covered the case and like the American Free Press. But this kind of brutality towards people, particularly in political cases, is extremely routine in the federal prisons. The Bond Reform Act that was passed by Reagan allows federal prosecutors to hold people who are accused of being so-called dangerous people without any conviction or criminal record. Until very recently, they've been allowed to hold those people indefinitely, often in subhuman conditions in solitary confinement. And this has been a routine procedure the Bureau of Prisons uses to extort false confessions from people. And really, these extorted false confessions are the bread and butter of the federal legal system. And it really has opened my eyes. I was always a critic of the U.S. government, but I was once somebody who fundamentally believed in the possibility of democratic change. And what I've really come to realize being in prison is that the U.S. government is fundamentally illegitimate. I mean, this is a group of extremely violent, essentially criminal people, not just in the United States towards their own citizens, but internationally. And they claim to be promoting democracy or the empowerment of people. But what they're really promoting is their own power over people in the name of democracy. Democracy for them has really become the World Democratic Revolution, I should say, has really become for them what the World Workers' Revolution was for the Soviet Union. And they really don't scruple against using the same tactics here domestically that the Soviets used to control their own citizenry. And I have unfortunately sort of been trapped in the middle of this.
You mentioned before that a couple of these characters involved in your cases happen to be Jews. Is that a common theme that runs through your cases?
There's only really been one court I've been in front of where the lead judge, at least. Now, there were three judge panels in the circuit courts, has not been Jewish. And now, it was also a Jewish fellow who dismissed the case twice. But at the appellate level, you have these sort of very radical Zionist, you know, advocates of Talmudic law, like Posner or Neuberger, who have been appointed, or neoconservatives. And they ally with the black sitting on the circuit court, and they rule that way. And that's sort of what American law has become, is these very ideological people sitting on the courts and making very ideological decisions. And, you know, I've come to my own belief that democracy, as practiced by the United States and as imposed by force on the rest of the world, is a fundamentally illegitimate system. And I have to say, we haven't even got to plugging my books.
Right.
There is a fellow out there, Harold Covington, who's written a number of books, and I think has certainly outlined what is probably the only solution to the current situation.
Don't have much time. Why don't we talk about, you've written already two books.
I've got two books published and one I'm working on. My first book was called Centuries of Revolution, Democracy, Communism, Zionism. I'm going to be down to 1 minute, so I have to go quickly. My second book is Tradition of the Mother. Centuries of Revolution is a brief history of the Jews and shows how these political ideologies have emerged from paganism that was absorbed into Judaism. It's about to go into a second edition with Romanian, German, and Spanish editions planned. Tradition of the Mother is my latest book. It expands on the opening chapters of Centuries and gives background on how the original Jewish religion formed from the paganism of the Near East. I got 15 seconds. And my latest book, Serpent's Blood, carries that into the Middle Ages. And Dave, unfortunately, I'm going to have to go. Thank you very much for letting me on here.
Thank you, Bill. When will we be talking to you again?
As soon as I can get to a phone. It might be a few weeks.
I'll be here.
All right.
All right, Bill.
Joining me on the line is William A. White from a federal prison in Oklahoma. Bill, thanks for joining us again today.
Well, thank you for having me back on, Dave.
Last time we spoke, you were in Chicago. Now, where are you?
I'm in the Oklahoma City Transfer Center, and I was fortunate enough not to be thrown in solitary confinement the moment that I arrived here. And by some other error, I've managed to get a bunch more time to use the phone, so I figured we could continue our interview and give also maybe a little bit of an update into what has happened since even Sunday. The Supreme Court has refused to hear my appeal.
It's the United States Supreme Court, right?
Yes, the United States Supreme Court refused to hear my appeal, which means that the government's decision that they can label the audiences of publications to be inherently violent, and thus to interpret any speech towards that audience as a solicitation of violence, stands. So this sort of unprecedented power that the United States has granted itself to attack the entire audience of a publication without identifying a single individual member of that publication to have ever been involved in any sort of violence, but to simply say because of a political view, an audience is inherently violent, that has now been affirmed for all purposes by the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, by them refusing to hear your case, you're saying?
That's correct. They've refused to hear it, which means that they uphold the decision of the Seventh Circuit.
Is that what that means, or does that mean they just don't want to get involved in it?
It means that they uphold it. They don't want to get involved in it, but that is the law now. I mean, the Seventh Circuit makes the law, and there's never been a case, a solicitation case, that has been decided in this manner in the past. So this new law that this Jewish federal judge Posner created with his opinion has now been essentially said that the Supreme Court has said that's okay.
So that's the law of the land now.
But it is in the Seventh Circuit.
And what exactly would someone have to do in order to violate this law?
Speak to an audience that the United States government feels is inherently violent. Criticize someone before an audience. What I did was criticize a federal juror on a website, and the judge determined that the audience of the website, all 150,000 monthly readers, unique readers, was inherently violent, and therefore my criticism could be interpreted as a solicitation of violence. So all you have to do is get in front of an audience that the government, for political reasons, has labeled inherently violent and say that I dislike this person, and that could be interpreted as a solicitation for that audience to commit violent acts.
Okay, well, the United States is getting better and better. That's great.
There's no way for people who are outside the political system to participate in American democracy. The goal of participating in the American system is not a correct one. What has to happen is that the American system has to be removed if good people are going to govern this country again.
Yeah.
If they ever did at all, I don't know. I'm beginning to have my doubts. What do you think?
I doubt that as well, and that's why I write my books. And we were going to, I think, talk a little bit more about my books. And, of course, I write basically on the philosophy of history or the interpretation of history. And I think it's actually amusing. I was just sent something published by Harold Covington. He published a draft of a part of Chapter 2 from my new book and then included a sort of a scathing criticism saying it was my efforts were ineffective because I had retreated into writing about history and religion. And I've tried to note to him that I am in prison and that these people do brutalize people who speak out on current political topics. And if I were to pursue, I think, the tactics he desired, I think that I would be cutting my own throat, kind of the way that things are now. For those who've seen what's happened recently with Matt Hale, where he's again been forbidden to even send mail to people outside of prison, I've been doing everything I can to do what I can while avoiding that kind of fate, because what would be the point if I can't speak to anyone at all? And further, I really don't think there's anything left to say about America. There's plenty to be done in this country, but again, the goal of trying to participate in the system through speaking about issues is really an unattainable goal. The government has absolutely forbidden anyone to speak out in a meaningful way or outside of the sort of false political dichotomy they've created. So I do what I can do, and one of the things I think is very important is the deconstruction of the progressive myth of history. The United States of America is dependent on this sort of false neo-Marxist narrative that it and its system is the culmination of all historical processes, and that this narrative is really the sole justification for American power. There is no pretense in this country that what the government does is based on right or wrong, or that it's engaged in service to some particular people, but merely that what it is doing is the inevitable result of history, and therefore everyone should simply get behind it because that's what's going to be. And to destroy this myth and to undermine the moral basis or the philosophical basis of American power involves a reevaluation of all values of history. And that is what I try to do in my books. Unfortunately, Dave, I'm being cut short here. I could try to call you later on today if you want to continue this. We could talk about some of the specific books in particular.
Yeah, that would be great. How much time do we have left?
We have 30 seconds, and it took a little while to set up, so I will try to call you in an hour. If not, I'll call you by no later than noon.
That would be great, Bill.
Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. In the little streets of Belfast, in the dark of early morn, British soldiers came running, breaking little homes with scorn. Hear the sobs of crying children, dragging fathers from their bed. Watch the scene as helpless mothers watch the blood fall from their heads. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. Not for them a judge or jury, or indeed a crime at all. Being Irish means they're guilty, so they're guilty one and all. Round the world a truth will echo, Cromwell's men are here again. England's name again is sullied in the eyes of honest men. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire. Proudly march behind our banner, proudly march behind our men. We will have them free to help us build a nation once again. On the people step together, proudly marching on your way. Never fear or never falter, till the boys come home to stay. Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons, but every man must stand behind the men behind the wire.
Armored cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons. But every man must stand behind the men behind the wire.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to talk about a book by Andy Corsi, which is a biography of Diana Moseley. Now, of course, Diana Moseley was one of the Mitford sisters, and this author goes a bit into her family. She says that her father, David, was very strict and very temperamental, but that his father, Bertie, was much more mild-mannered. And Bertie was a member of the family that really loved Germany, and it was in Bertie's honor that one of the daughters, Unity, acquires the middle name of Valkyrie. Also, Sydney, mother of Diana, was also rather eccentric in that she followed Mosaic law because she believed that Orthodox Jews never got cancer. So they were this very aristocratic British family, and they had quite a large family. They were always trying for a boy, but they only had one boy by the name of Tom. They live in various estates. And in 1926, one of their estates by the name of Asthrol was sold, and David decided to build a new estate called Swinbrook. Now, at this point, Sydney and the girls were sent to Paris because Swinbrook wasn't quite ready for a time after they had sold their Asthrol estate. And when Diana was living in Paris, she was almost ready to come out, as they used to say, to start dating at this point. She gets to know this artist by the name of Helios, and apparently there was some kind of an affair going. Now, later on, when the family moves into Swinbrook, one of the things about that house is that it afforded very little privacy. And I'm really not sure why, but it's possible that David may have designed it in such a way that he wanted to keep an eye on his daughters. And at one point, they find the diary of Diana, and they're very shocked, and she ends up being sent to Devon. Now, throughout her life, there are always shifting alliances between Diana and her other sisters. Now, young men are always falling in love with Diana, and even one of the Churchills by the name of Randolph was very much in love with her, but she was not interested in him. At this point in her young life, she falls very much in love with Brian Guinness, or at least she was attracted to him and found him suitable. But it always seemed that Brian was more in love with her than she was with him. Even her sisters, and especially Nancy and the rest of the family, tried to tell Diana that she was really too young to get married. But Diana was very insistent, and she does end up marrying Brian. And this is all right for a while, although Brian is much more introverted than she is. There is somewhat of a strain. Brian wants a lot of children. She's happy with two children. But eventually, Diana goes to a party because there's a lot of parties and luncheons going on in this social milieu that she's part of. And in particular, she goes to a birthday party, and this friend of hers, St. John Hutchinson, puts Diana next to Moseley. Now, at first, Moseley might not really be her type, and under different circumstances, perhaps nothing would have come of it. But by this time, Moseley was out of Parliament, and so he had a lot more free time. Now, Moseley is really quite the philanderer at this point in his life, even though he's married, and he's always romancing various married women in this upper aristocratic class. His wife, Simmy, is very sweet, and she's easily deceived, but she also forgives easily. He's always playing the field. And one of the things that Simi starts to discern about this relationship that he's having with Diana is that it seems Mosley is really falling for Diana in a way that he doesn't fall for most women. And at the time, Mosley had two mistresses that he actually gives up for Diana. But he tells Diana that he really cannot divorce Simi. He feels badly for Simi. She's had some health problems, and he really feels that he has an obligation to her. Now, this leads to some complicated situations. At one point, Diana wants to go to the south of France, and she's going to meet Mosley there. And there's this letter that she expects from Mosley, and she takes ill. And she has this terrible fear that the letter is going to arrive at the hotel and she's not going to be there to intercept it. It's really, when you look at it, somewhat comical. She manages to have someone go and take the letter for her. She manages to get out of it in some way, but she knows that she's always inviting scandal. And eventually, Diana really doesn't want to be married to Brian anymore. Diana's family, they try to talk her out of it. They also try to persuade Mosley that he has to stop seeing Diana. And at one point, Brian writes a letter to Diana, and he says, "I'm the one that you really love, and, you know, I'm your first, and don't you love me more than anyone else?" And apparently she didn't, because eventually she just gets a flat of her own. She divorces him. And even though she's been told that Mosley isn't going to marry her, still, she just walks right out on her husband. And, of course, it's considered quite the scandal, especially in that day. And she said she doesn't want much. She just wants enough to be comfortable. Now, as far as Mosley was concerned, he decided he was just going to come clean with Simi. He was going to tell her almost all the women that he'd been with. And after that, Simi was very embarrassed, and she can't even see her friends anymore without being embarrassed, because apparently, everybody has been dating Mosley, to try and put it nicely. But Mosley just wants to be honest. Now, a little while after this, Simi has been having kidney problems. And she ends up dying of these kidney problems. Meanwhile, Diana, she's been getting more involved in politics. And she's been going to the various Nuremberg rallies. And it talks about the various songs that were composed in those days by the English fascists. And one of them is Hail the New Dawn. And it says that Mosley was always someone that wanted to be the only fascist group. So that led him to have flicks with other groups. One of the things about the fact that Simi dies, about her death, is that at the time, social mores were different. And for a while, there was a prevailing opinion that even though Simi was gone, that Mosley and Diana were never going to get married because it was just too unseemly. Especially because Simi was so embarrassed that it was almost like she died of embarrassment. And because of the guilt that Diana and Mosley would feel, that they would really never get married. But eventually they do, of course, get married. They get married in Germany to avoid fanfare. But obviously, if guilt didn't stop them before, it's not going to stop them when Simi is gone. One of the interesting things that happens as Diana is getting more and more involved in politics, she starts taking Unity with her to various rallies. In 1934, Unity begs her parents to send her to Germany. They're reluctant because Unity is still very young. She might be around 17 at this point, but eventually she convinces them that she really wishes to learn German. And this wasn't unusual because a lot of aristocratic families in England were tied to Germany. Now, she keeps on trying to meet Hitler. She becomes very fixated with him. Eventually, on the 9th of February, she does meet him. And she says that she was completely fulfilled at the sight of him. And it talked about the effect he had on women and how there were women that wanted to marry him. There were always women writing to him that wanted to have his baby. And there were even women that would throw themselves in front of his car to get hit by his car so that he would come out and comfort them. So just a really unusual effect on women. One of the things that Mosley is always having difficulty with, and I talked about this before when I read his biography, was that he was always having trouble with funding. And he does get some funding from Mussolini. And of course, that'll be problematic later when the Mosleys end up being sent to prison. Now, eventually, many people in the Mitford family do get involved with National Socialism in some way, the two exceptions being Nancy, who was interested in fascism at first and then is turned away from it or becomes disenchanted because she sees that it's somewhat violent. And then also Jessica is one that sides with Nancy. Now, things get tough for Mosley in a lot of ways because there's something called the Battle of Cable Street that leads to a public order act. And that makes it much more difficult for Mosley's group. And he's always having trouble having enough funding and getting members, as I've said. So he has a lot of ups and downs and a lot of stress with his group. Eventually, as they start getting into the war, of course, they do pass a Public Security Act, and that was why they ended up going to prison. One of the things that happens that's kind of interesting and kind of tragic is that Unity is very much against the war. Unity takes the war very hard, and Unity decides that if there is going to be a war between Germany and England, she does not want to live to see it. She ends up shooting herself. She goes to a park in Munich. At this point in her life, she's pretty much living in Munich and just ends up deciding that that's where she's going to shoot herself after writing many letters to friends saying goodbye. Now, what happens, though, is she does not die. She expects to, and she says that she wants to be buried in Munich with just a party badge and a photo of Hitler. But they find her body in the park, and it turns out she's unconscious, but she's not dead. And the bullet is lodged so far back that they cannot operate. Now, today they might have been able to, but back then they couldn't help her. She, to a certain degree, regains some semblance of consciousness, and Hitler asks her if she wants to stay in Munich or go back to England, and she indicates that she wants to go back to England. So they end up transferring her back to England, and then the family really has to take care of her because, of course, she really becomes an invalid. She's partly paralyzed. She has to learn how to speak and to write and read again. And for a while, she learns these things, and then after a few years, she forgets how to write. And after 9 years, which is really interesting, the number 9, because it makes me think of a sacrifice at Uppsala, where they had the 9 various sacrificial offerings, and I don't know if they were able to live for 9 days and then were sacrificed, but the number 9 comes into play in Germanic religion, so that's really interesting. And while Unity is an invalid, she goes to church a lot, she sings a lot of hymns, she's always very happy and very talkative and has a wonderful attitude. Mamie is still semi-aware of politics, I'm not really sure, because the book doesn't really make it clear. But apparently doesn't live very long after the war because, you know, she dies in 1947. Diana Mosley and Oswald, Diana lives into her 90s. Oswald lives into his 80s, and he's always trying to restart his party. After the war is over and some of the restrictions on him are finally lifted, he tries to start something called the Union Party, and it's basically the fascist party, but it's thinly veiled. But he can make it in mainstream politics, and in 1966 he just gives up on that. But I think the character that comes out, for me anyway, is the most interesting in all of these stories, is the character of Unity, and at a point I would like to read a book about Unity Mitford, which is called Unity Mitford, A Quest by David Pierce Jones. So that may be a talk for another time. So thank you very much for listening.
Now, a quick comment for our British listeners especially, and for our American listeners as well. Now, some of you have remarked and or complained about my playing Irish rebel songs in general and IRA music in particular on this show. Now, for the record, yes, I do know that the present-day IRA are Marxists, sort of. Although, to be fair, there is a great deal of opposition to this trend within the Irish Republican movement itself, and it was in fact the cause of the split between the officials and the provisional wing in 1969, and later the split between the provos and the INLA. The provos being the good old-fashioned kill Brits and Protestants kind of IRA men, and the officials and the INLA wanting to be nice, trendy, lefty, radical types. It was rather legendary when I was over there that in the summer, when the Irish-American tourists from Boston and New York were over in Dublin visiting the old sod, the Sinn Féin bookstore on Parnell Square had pictures of the Pope, JFK, and Padraig Pearse hanging on the walls. And then, from October to May, those came down and they put up pictures of Chairman Mao and Che Guevara instead. Now, all of that having been admitted, a large part of the Northwest novels are based on the 5 years of close-up observation that I made of the situation in Ireland, and on the strategy, tactics, and organization of the IRA, and to a lesser extent the UVF, plus the overall ambiance of living in a society where the Zionist government has lost its credible monopoly of armed force, and where there are multiple elements who can successfully apply direct action solutions to human problems and human behavior. Now, that's what I've always tried to convey in my books, not just ideas, but an atmosphere, a mindset. I say to you again, we must not be afraid or ashamed to study communists and emulate them as revolutionaries, because the simple fact is that historically, their revolutions win, while our attempts tend to fall short because we just can't bring ourselves to do the necessary. Like when the AWB had Botha and Mandela in their grasp in that building in Johannesburg, but instead they just milled around the lobby not knowing what the hell to do because Terre Blanche was off drunk somewhere and there was nobody to give the orders. Now, I know this seeming IRA kick of mine pisses off some of you British comrades out there, but let me put it to you like this. Suppose, just suppose, that there was a British nationalist equivalent to the IRA that was dealing with your immigration problem in your tiny little overcrowded island in what I believe you guys refer to as an extra-parliamentary fashion. Would your present situation be so completely hopeless, knowing that white people in Britain would eventually do like the Irish did on Good Friday and shoot their way to a place at the table with those Whitehall gits? It's kind of like the gun control debate here, a matter of perspective. I tell wishy-washy whites that they need to stop thinking in terms of having a gun in the hands of a criminal, meaning a black or a Mexican, pointed at them, and they need to start envisioning that gun in their own hands pointed at the shitskins. I should also point out that I do on occasion play Ulster loyalist music on here when I can find some good examples, and if you guys want to point me to some, lay it on me. Just remember, I no longer have the technical capacity to rip soundtracks off YouTube videos, and so you're going to have to get me an actual MP3 file. Now, all that having been said, here's a cheery little IRA song, but don't think of them as provos. Imagine our own people singing like this while we rip away Washington or Whitehall's credible monopoly of armed force.
And just down along the Bond Road, that's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left eye, another one on me right. A clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. I was stopped by a soldier, he said you are a swine. He hit me with his rifle and he kicked me in the groin. I begged and I pleaded, oh, my manners were polite. But all the time I'm thinking of me
little arm of light. And it's down in the bog side, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company, a comrade on me left and another one on me right, and a clip of ammunition for me little arm of light. Brave RUC man came marching up our street. 600 British soldiers he had lined up at his feet. Come out, you curly Fenians, come on out and fight. He cried, I'm only joking, when he heard the Armalite. And it's down in Wallahi, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company, a comrade on the left and another one on the right, a clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. Well, the army came to visit me, it was in the early hours, with Saracens and Saladins and ferret armored cars. The thought that had me cornered, but I gave them all a fright, with the armor piercing bullets off me little Armalite. And it's down in the new lodge, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company, a comrade on me left and another one on me right, a clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. Well, when Pryor came to Belfast to see the battles won, the generals they had told him, we've got them on the run. But corporals and privates, while on patrol at night, say remember narrow water and the bloody Armalite. And it's down across the glen, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company, a comrade on me left and another one on me right, and a clip of ammunition for me little Armalite.
Okay, now for the deep philosophical part of the show. Aren't you thrilled? Guys, I got some good news and some bad news. Now, the good news is, yes, I really do have pretty much all the answers. The bad news is that I've already told them to you. I get a lot of people coming to me by email and sometimes sitting on my sofa in person who kind of look at me like expectant puppies. Okay, Harold, we're here. Now tell us the rest of it. The great secret plan as to how you're going to make all this happen in time for us to have a nice, wonderful life like America promises. Tell us how you're going to keep the promise that America made to us and never kept. Sorry, guys. Like I said, I do, in fact, have the answers, yes, but I've already told them to you. And if you don't want to hear them, then there's not much I can do. Now, sometimes people are deeply disappointed when they come to me expecting to find some great hidden truth or grand strategy or secret NVA army hidden in the North Woods, whatever, and all they find here is an ordinary, aging white boy in indifferent health with all the problems and character defects that one might expect to find in someone who's lived for 60 years in America. Now, the answers are there, guys. All you need to know. They're available in 5 novels and 180 podcasts and God knows how many millions of written and spoken words since 1972. Now, when certain people finally come to understand that there is no rest of it, no big secret, no hidden bunkers or compounds in the woods, that the rest of it consists of their moving here with everything they have and building their lives anew from scratch, and when the penny finally drops that there is no fast-forward button on the VCR of life, it can be a pretty bad experience. A lot of them feel that I have in some way betrayed them, because they believe that I promised them something in my novels and in my podcasts. Well, they're right. I am promising you guys something. I'm promising you a new life, and a new world, and a new land, where you will never have to look at another ugly black or brown face. I promise that I will help you in any way I can to achieve that world. I do not promise that I will simply give it all to you. I do not promise that you yourself will be able to achieve this wonderful new world without risk, inconvenience, work, and suffering. I don't believe I ever have, but somehow some people just never seem to pick up on that part of the message. Now, my problem, or one of them, is that apparently I write and speak too well. I get people all involved in my fictional world of the NVA and the Northwest Republic, and sometimes I raise unrealistic expectations. And for that, I apologize. Believe me, I wish I could live up to what all of you expect of me. But it's also a white character issue. As I've learned over the past few years, while physical Northwest migration is the first step and arguably the biggest, even once it's accomplished, the fact of migration alone does not in itself guarantee that we've got an alpha on our hands. A lone wolf who really can live and function all alone in the forest, away from the herd. Sometimes people are coming here looking for another herd to join. When we can, we'll give that to them, but that time is not now. Now, the fact is that many white people join the movement seeking strength, white strength, because they have so little of it themselves. They are desperately searching for strong white men like those we all since lived hundreds of years ago. White men who are not afraid of the government or the niggers or the Mexicans or the militarized police in the black body armor. They're looking for white men who are not afraid, period. White men who will protect their families, their communities, and their people against the evil dark things that populate the world. Now, we all seem to have a genetic memory of white men like that inside us, and we instinctively seek these long-vanished, strong white males to provide so much of what no longer exists in Obama's America. Now, I know because this, in part, was what I was looking for in my own youth when I went to South Africa and Rhodesia. And to some degree, I found it there. In those days, we all thought that those countries were the great white paradises. And to some degree, they were. Definite improvement over here, anyway. I also recall that even back then, when there actually were countries in the world that could legitimately be viewed in that way, most of the considerably larger American white nationalist community we had back in those days stayed put where they were, and they never went there even to visit, much less to make their lives there. Now, we had weird things going on in our minds even back then. I just said that there is no fast-forward button on the VCR of life, but as cutesy as that sounds, it's not quite true. Actually, there are some things that would really speed things along, but I don't have them hidden in my pocket. You're going to have to supply me with these two things that I need, which are boots on the ground and a large amount of money, the political equivalent of startup capital. Bodies and boodle. Carcasses and cash. Anybody know any racist millionaires? Now, you know, those so-called right-wing fat cats that are supposed to finance us wicked evil racist types from behind the scenes? I see them on TV and in the movies all the time, acting sinister. I don't suppose anybody knows any of these people in real life. If so, don't be shy. I have met two or three guys like Bill Seabrook and Herb Horton and a few others in my time who probably would qualify to a small degree as right-wing fat cats, although they were by no means mega-rich, just reasonably successful businessmen who were pissed off because the Democrats were letting the niggers run wild and taking too much of their money in taxes. Guys like that are very seldom into genuine revolution. They've got too much to lose, and they have a tendency to reason that since they're paying the piper, that gives them the right to call the tune, which I would never allow beyond a certain point, which is why I've never had more to do with these semi-mythical right-wing fat cat types. We were talking about movement burnout and disappointment. Now, we, American white boys, spend our lives waiting for somebody else to quote-unquote do something about the horror that we all live in. And for a growing number of people, I have become that somebody else that everybody's waiting on. Now, let's be honest. When we say that we're waiting for somebody else to do something, what we're waiting for is for some white man on a white horse to appear, preferably somebody from within the system so you can put a bumper sticker on your car without getting it vandalized by niggers and Democrat scum. Somebody who's got guts enough to go first, to say out loud what you yourselves don't dare to say. Someone specifically with the guts to pick up the gun and fight, and use that gun with sufficient skill and ferocity so that the dictator's servants in the black body armor can't defeat him and destroy him. Now, when that happens, as it will someday, this mystical great white leader will thereby give us our permission slip. Then it'll be all right for us to, in turn, join under the flag like that song I played a few weeks ago, because someone else has gone first and survived, and by doing so, he has thereby given us our permission slip. That permission slip that white boys have to have before they can be brave. White boys will join a growing army. They'll jump on a bandwagon, but they won't start one because they don't have a permission slip. Guys, let me cut to the chase here. You have my permission. You have my permission to show courage and initiative and idealism. You have my permission to come here and make a new white life for yourselves and your family. You have my permission to be who you are, to think and to say what you want, and to live your lives without wallowing in diversity and filth. That about do it? Now, as for that white strength you're looking for, the Northwest Republic will one day provide it for real. A strong, powerful, and safe home for all of our race. But you're going to have to provide it first. Now, just to show that they do play music other than Irish Rebel songs, here's the Wolf Tones. The other day, I was diddling with some of my books on the shelf, and I found my copy of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's most famous work, The Gulag Archipelago. It's about a 30-year-old paperback. I got it at some book exchange somewhere, and I've been lugging it around all these years. Anyway, I was leafing through it, and I found that at some point many years ago, I highlighted the following well-known passage. And how we burned in the camps later, thinking, what would things have been like if every security operative, when he went out at night to make an arrest, had been uncertain whether he would return alive and had to say goodbye to his family? Or if, during periods of mass arrests, as for example in Leningrad, when they arrested a quarter of the entire city, people had not simply sat there in their lairs, paling with terror at every bang of the downstairs door and at every step on the staircase, but had understood that they had nothing left to lose and had boldly set up in the downstairs hall an ambush of half a dozen people with axes, hammers, pokers, or whatever else was at hand. After all, you knew ahead of time that those blue caps were out at night for no good purpose, and you could be sure ahead of time that you'd be cracking the skull of a cutthroat. Or what about the Black Maria sitting there on the end of the street with one lonely chauffeur? What if it had been driven off or its tire spiked? The organs would very quickly have suffered a shortage of officers and transport, and notwithstanding all of Stalin's thirst, the cursed machine would have ground to a halt. If we didn't love freedom enough, and even more, we had no awareness of the real situation. We spent ourselves in one unrestrained outburst in 1917, and then we hurried to submit. We submitted with pleasure. We purely and simply deserved everything that happened afterward. I can see what Solzhenitsyn is saying. Most white Americans probably deserve what's going to happen to them. Do you? I spend a lot of my time on this show asking you to do certain things, entirely legal things and eminently doable things, but vital nonetheless. You are clearly very worried about the consequences if you do what I ask you to do. Just remember, not doing something can have consequences just as damaging and serious as doing the wrong thing. Russia survived Stalin and the communists. I'm not at all sure that the white race on this continent will survive Obama and the Democrats. Come home, white people. Come home. Now. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front. Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.